Hello, I'm Rory McKiernan, author of Hitching for Hope, coming to you from County Clare on the wild west coast of Ireland. You're very welcome to the Love and Courage podcast. Welcome back to all you regular listeners, folk from throughout Ireland, France, Norway, the United States, Australia, New Zealand, Korea, Argentina, Zambia, and any one of the 50 plus countries where people have been tuning in from. It's great to have you here listening to the podcast, and a very big welcome to new listeners. Do check out the archives when you finish this great episode, and a huge thanks, as always, to all you wonderful patrons and supporters who chip in to support the podcast over at loveandcourage.org. Before we get going, I want to share some good news with you. My book, Hitching for Hope, recently picked up a Best Book Award from the American Book Fest, and it was also chosen as Book of the Month by IrishCentral.com. So great to have this new momentum behind the book and to get all those stories and messages of hope, community, connection, and kindness out, rippling out into the world again. So more info on the book. If you haven't come across it yet, you'll find lots of information, reviews and everything online, and you can buy it as an ebook, audiobook and paperback. And more information on hitchingforhope.com, or your local bookstore should have it. My guest in this episode is Kindred Motes. Kindred is an award-winning social impact entrepreneur and an inspirational voice for change from working-class rural Alabama in the southern United States. After approximately a decade working with some of the world's leading social justice organizations, Kindred recently established the Washington, D.C.-based KM Strategies Group to support organizations working for social impact and positive change. I first encountered Kindred many years ago when he was working with the Wallace Global Fund, and I was really struck by his intellect, his passion, his insight, his drive, and his deep commitment to change on so many issues, including LGBTQI plus rights, which has been informed by his own experiences growing up gay in the Deep South. Kindred is also passionate about mental health supports, immigration reform, democracy participation, and amplifying citizens' voices in general. He also has a lot to say on the topic of burnout and well-being and how we can create healthier and more appealing workplace cultures, something I think is particularly important in the world today when there's so much stress and burnout among us. So you'll get to hear lots more of his thoughts around that. I really enjoyed this conversation with Kindred, and I want to say a huge congrats to him and his partner also on their recent engagement. May they be very happy together. We're all about celebrating the love here on the Love and Courage podcast. Now, without further ado, let's jump in and get started with this conversation with Kindred Motes. Kindred, you're very welcome to the Love and Courage podcast. I want to jump in straight away and ask you what you've probably been asked so many times before and maybe tired of answering, but it is, I would just love to know about your name, not just your first name, but also your last name.
Oh, sure. So, well, thanks so much, Rory, for having me. Yeah, it's definitely something that I've been asked a lot. Usually in a queue at Starbucks or somewhere else, trying to get a coffee when I'm having to spell it. But Kindred, which is my first name, came from my great-great-grandfather, and it was his middle name. It's an old family name. People often ask me whether my parents were hippies or, you know, they met at some 70s music festival or something. But no, it's an old family name. And then my last name is originally, I think, as best I can tell, was originally French and was Delamotte, but then became Motes in England. And then they moved from England to the Carolinas in the states where I live and have been in the country for quite some time. But I think, as best I can tell, the rest of my family were kind of a mixture of Irish, Scottish, English, you know, the amalgamation that we're famously known for in Appalachia and the South. So
wow, that's very interesting. So I'm going to make a guess to say you haven't met too many or any Kindreds. Has it happened?
I have not. I've seen a lot of companies and brands recently that have come up with a name and have joked with some friends that I made very poor decisions in my late teens and early 20s, and I probably should have tried to trademark a couple of those things. I guess that's just one of the things that happens. But no, I've never met another Kindred. I would love to. That'd be, maybe we should find like a little a little group of kindreds around the world and have a little convening.
On that topic, there aren't that many Rurys. They do exist in Ireland. They are around and internationally, but I guess Rory is the more commonly known English language version. But there was a guy on Instagram called Rory who set up a group of Rurys on Instagram and tried to create a dialogue. But I have to admit, I didn't have sufficient interest in having this Rory group. And then I have noticed another guy whose Instagram handle, I hope he doesn't mind me quoting it, but I'll probably promote him in doing so. His Instagram handle is The Real Rory. So I guess he's laying claim to...
Shots fired.
Yeah. Big time. So that does not surprise me that brands are hooking on to that name, because what really strikes me about it, and we're not going to make this a podcast about your name, so we will move on. You can trust me on that. But when I see it, it sort of evokes a positive, warm sentiment, and that must be a good thing. I mean, do you benefit from that?
Yeah, you know, it's something that I've actually wondered before. I think particularly as I was first starting to, as a young adult, apply for jobs and meet people, and I had a lot of people who very early on, when I would meet them, would ask me when I changed my name or when I decided to go by that name, because I think they thought that it wasn't my real name. I think that there, and particularly in a lot of Southern families, there's a tendency to try and use old family names. And I think as a result, sometimes people sound a little archaic in their name or something, you know, in a way that it doesn't really hit the modern ear as being current or something they've heard before. And I wondered a lot of times whether how much your name or your kind of environment determines your destiny. And I know that there's a lot of ways you can slice and dice that, but especially your name, like, does it determine what sort of fields you are welcomed into, what sort of people you work with, who takes you seriously, who doesn't? And it's hard to evaluate in the abstract, because I feel like a lot of what could have been is completely unknown. But I do think about it, especially given that I've worked so much in movement communications and advocacy communications in social justice campaigns, whether the idea of being kind of a kindred or a kindred spirit or a collective, you know, kindred, which became kin, at least in the US is how, and especially in the South, is how we would talk about being family. We would say, you know, oh, I'm kin to him. Mm. And that would mean that he's my family member. He's part of my community. Mm. And so, I think it's interesting to think about the funny ways in which sometimes life kind of imitates the situational things that aren't actually a choice for you. You know, maybe I didn't choose that name, but the things that happened afterwards kind of chose me because of it. And I don't know the extent to which I, you know, give that theory too much credit, but I do think about it sometimes, and it's interesting. It's funny that you ask, because I think it is something that maybe does hit a social justice or a justice oriented person as being particularly evocative, maybe.
Yeah. And there are so many aspects to our identities and our formation that we're handed and born with and given and, I suppose, socialized with, and names being one of them, and religions perhaps being another, and things that perhaps we had no choice over as a child, you know. So you mentioned a couple of times already your Southern origins, and I definitely got a distinct sense of identity and a distinct culture there as well. And I think those of us that aren't from the United States, probably we get stereotypical views of the United States as an entity, as a country. And my experience of the States is that there is no singular entity, insofar as there are multiple states with multiple regional cultures and variations, and there's indigenous culture, and there's African American or Latino culture and Southern culture. And then we talk about Irish America, but we rarely talk about the Appalachian version that you referenced there. And then the mashup that we hear in old time music and fiddle music and all the confluence that goes on there. But it obviously is an important part of your life. I certainly detect that, or has been an important part of your life, like your identity, your origins, as they are for everybody, really. But, you know, being given the name and it's speaking to tradition. So I'd like to just get a better sense of what traditions you are from and what your family origins are, what you grew up in and around.
Yeah, I appreciate that question. I think it's something that, so I grew up in Alabama and in Northern Alabama, and in particular in a small, very small, extremely rural community. I think I had about 450 to 500 people who lived in my community, but that was over a great distance, and people were sort of very sparsely located, kind of across the area. So it wasn't even technically a town or, you know, a village or anything that would be common elsewhere. But I grew up, my grandparents were farmers. My dad and my mom, my mom and dad lived near my grandparents. My entire family kind of all lived within a very short driving distance from each other. And that sense of closeness and community was always so formative, I think, in how I thought about the world and how I thought about closeness and community and family. And I remember watching TV as a kid, young kid in the early 90s, and seeing people traveling to other places or having next door neighbors and all of those things, you know, traveling for the holidays mm-hmm. to go to their grandparents mm-hmm. and or going next door to play basketball with their neighbors after school. And neither of those were really accessible references for me, because I neither had to travel to visit family, nor did I have a next door neighbor. So I think I grew up in an extremely rural place, and I think that was very formative. It's interesting that you mentioned the power of the connection between Southern or Appalachian music and Scots Irish music. I think that is something that was a very prominent presence in my life. I grew up in a very musical family. My dad and his family sang as when my dad was a child and you know, in church and traveled, kind of singing together. My mom and her three sisters sang, and my grandmother played the piano, and they all were very informed, I think, by music and the cultural heritage that had been passed down to them. And I remember being really, really interested when I got to college in listening to some of the old English, Irish, Scottish folk songs and finding that similarity. And it felt like I was going home, even though I would be thousands of miles away at the time. I went to graduate school over in the UK, and you know, just finding those similarities really, I think, drove home for me the universality of music, of connection, and the ways in which we think of ourselves as very different, but we're really not. And a lot of the songs that you know, my grandparents or great grandparents would have sung to me when I was a small child or baby were songs that, you know, someone was singing in Ireland 300 years ago, and the only thing that had changed was they were being sung with a Southern accent instead of an Irish one. So I think about that a lot. And I think that for a very long time for me, I'm ashamed to say it now, but I think I was a bit averse to being identified as Southern because of the things that I felt kind of came with that in the form of baggage or you know, the assumptions that people would make about you. And so I worked very, very hard at the age of 14, 15 to get rid of my accent and to not sound like I was from the South, because I had been made fun of for it when I would go away to conferences or to other things with people from other parts of the country. And I realized early on that, at least at that point in time, you could either have a Southern accent or you could be considered intelligent. And, you know, didn't see a lot of room for keeping both. And it's one of, it may sound silly, but I think it's one of my biggest regrets from that period, that I wish I had kept it, because I think it would be a powerful counterexample to the stereotype. If, you know, imagine you have someone who works in advocacy and movements and didn't change that about themselves.
Yeah. Well, I certainly don't think you're alone in that. And I think we have some very high profile examples of political leaders that have downplayed their accent and also then upplayed their accent or returned to their accent when it suited them. And I suppose I'm in that mix myself, in that I'm from a very relatively rural part of Ireland, and it has a very distinct accent, and I can't say I have it anymore. I don't remember ever trying to consciously change it, but I suppose I've been gone from there over 20 years, and I don't know, it just kind of filtered out. But they're to the finely tuned ear, they'll pick up bits and pieces of it. But I definitely have come to have a greater appreciation of diversity. Like, we're talking about diversity in general, and accents are another representation of diversity. And why do we want a sort of a monoculture of anything? You know, but I definitely, like, that is so distinct within the cultural and political output of the United States that we do hear a northern version of reality, you know. And that idea that, you know, also implicit in that is possibly some sort of urban v rural, and urban being progress and rural being regress. But yet the urban folk are highly dependent on the rural folk for the food that they eat and the shelter that they have and every other thing. And I think that's been played out, particularly I noticed during the pandemic when people were fearing that they would have no food on their shelves. Suddenly there was a new appreciation for rural folk who get their food. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's so true. You become very accustomed to ignoring people who are not convenient for you or who don't exist as part of your everyday life until you get to the point where you have to and you can no longer ignore it. And I think that's very true. I also think that dynamic is part of what has allowed those rural communities, I think, often to get involved or support, you know, political movements or leaders who, you know, aren't advocating on their behalf in the way that they think they are, because they feel so sort of marginalized or ignored by other people that they, you know, someone shows them an ounce of attention and they're very vulnerable to, you know, to whatever it is that person is peddling.
Yeah, it's a very good point. So, Kendra, going back to the family roots, I have a real distinct visual that you painted there, you know, from that sort of sparsely populated area and the musicality also. And did that influence your life directly in the sense that did you take up music or song or dance or anything like that?
I did. Yeah, I grew up singing all the time, and it's something I only really do in the shower these days, but I was involved in music and singing all throughout school, both in primary school, secondary school, and then in college. I had a scholarship to be part of a vocal group, and that was part of what allowed me to afford going to college when I was there. So I had to do weekly lessons and be part of what was called a concert choir of a large group of people, and then a 16-person a cappella group. So I was one of the four baritone basses in the group, and got to learn a lot of different musical styles. And it was interesting because I think for me it had always been a source of joy and comfort, and then it was kind of a requirement or a box ticking exercise for, you know, for being able to afford college. And it's interesting when something becomes your job, I think you learn very quickly whether you love it or you hate it, and whether the passion is truly there or it isn't. And for me, I did truly love it. I think I had the chance to realize that music is a form in and of itself of communication, you know, and you can reach people in a really powerful way through song, through music, whether you're playing, whether you're singing, whether you're writing it. And so that was, I think that was something that really, really did bring a lot of extra joy into my life. And even now, as I'm, you know, just taking breaks or finding ways to recharge, I often find that it's something that I turn to as a sort of palliative or source of comfort when things are going crazy, just to, you know, pop in my headphones, go for a walk and listen to something that is comforting to me, because I think that it reminds me of home. It reminds me of my family. And there's a very strong connection in my mind between things you pass down and things that bring you kind of comfort and joy and strength. And music for me has always been one of those, for sure.
Wow, Well, I certainly predict a comeback here on the stage at some point, Kindred. I look forward to hearing the musical version of this. So you mentioned your family there. Can you talk to me a little bit more about what kind of people they were or are, and what the influences were in the household, and how did that affect your upbringing, and what was young Kindred like beyond the music? What were you interested in, and what were you up to, and at what point did the social consciousness enter the arena?
Sure. Yeah. I think it's something that I think about a lot, the influence that my parents in particular had on my own thinking. My mom was a U.S. Postal Service worker when I was born, and for the first part of my life. So she worked first as a letter carrier or post carrier, as I suppose most of your audience would say. And she was also would work as a clerk at the Postal Service, and so at that point, that was something that had been somewhat of a family tradition. My grandmother was a letter carrier as well. And in the rural communities, that's something that, you know, you may have as well in Ireland, was really for a very, very long period of time, a lifeline for the communities, because before the internet, it really was pretty radical and transformational that the US Postal Service would deliver to everywhere, anywhere in the country for the same rate. You know, the cost of a stamp, you can get it wherever you need it to go. And that was really the only form of sort of social equity I think a lot of people benefited from, because it was the only thing that was even kind of, no matter where you lived, whether you were in Manhattan or you were in Somerville, Alabama. So that was something that I, you know, later on in life, as I looked back, I realized that my own belief in government and the power of government to provide sort of radical innovations and solutions was brought on from that. My dad, similarly, my dad worked as a United Auto Workers employee. He worked for a series of GM, General Motors factories as an assembly line worker. And so both my parents had union jobs. They, you know, worked as working class, you know, everyday American workers, and were extremely, extremely hardworking people, very, very intelligent, very kind. And, you know, they instilled in me early on the importance of hard work and being accountable, but also being honest. And I think that the other piece of that puzzle is when my brother was born. He's 8 years younger than me. My mom took some time off from the Postal Service to be at home with him. And when she decided to go back to work, she actually started her own small business and had an antique shop. She had collected antiques and kind of loved going to estate sales and, you know, flea markets and a bunch of other things when I was a kid, which I was dragged along to and hated as a kid. I would stay in the car and read, you know, the latest Harry Potter book for the third time, or whatever else I could get my hands on, because I was a voracious reader and still am. But she started that small business and was in business in my hometown for I think around 15 years, and since then has gone on to do other small business work with my dad once he retired. But I think that's something that was really an early example to me of entrepreneurship and using relationships and community and the idea of being a responsible community member who has a business, giving back, donating, hosting community events, you know, using business not as a mechanism for profit or for personal gain, but as a way to, you know, make an honest living, provide for your family, but then also build relationships with people. That's something that I think my mom learned from her father, who had a small business as well, selling tractor equipment and farm supply materials. And so I grew up kind of around that, and I feel like it was steeped in me a bit, where, you know, I would spend a lot of my time just around them and seeing them conduct, you know, business with people. Or in my town, it was always, you know, somebody that we knew, and they would pop in and have a Coca-Cola and chat over something, and maybe they bought something, maybe they didn't, but it was very sociable. In terms of me as a young kid, I think I was always very outgoing, and I really loved finding ways to travel, even though I never flew in a plane until I was 18, and have since then have really tried to make up for lost time. But I found a lot of adventure and escape and knowledge through reading, and my parents really nurtured that, and I'm so grateful for it. I think they probably knew from an early age that I was kind of had my eye on somewhere else, and I think they could have been very negative about that, but they weren't. And so I felt I had a lot of family support for trying new things, for kind of coming into my own. And I think the social consciousness question was something that, you know, to be honest, I had a very, in retrospect, I think of it as a golden childhood. You know, my family was not by any means rich or particularly privileged, but I never wanted for anything. We had love and we had each other, and, you know, they were hardworking and had been fortunate to be able to provide that environment for us. But I think I knew from an early age that there was a lot of suffering in the world, and my parents, you know, I was raised in the church, and my parents, faith was and is very, very important to them, and so that sense of giving back, doing what you can, meeting people where they are, and the culture of service was something that I saw them live out daily. And you know, I have come to my own conclusions about kind of faith and belief systems and service and everything else, but it very much was, I think, deeply rooted in their example and their experience, mm-hmm. and their selflessness there. But the primary catalyst, I think, for me was moving away. And I lived in Birmingham, Alabama for my undergraduate experience, which most of your listeners will probably be somewhat familiar with as the sort of hotbed and birthplace of the civil rights movement, Birmingham, Montgomery, and Atlanta kind of collectively as the triumvirate, mm-hmm. but Birmingham in particular being the place of, you know, the church bombings and the Bull Connor as the police commissioner, and the fire hoses being used on families and children and dogs, and all of those horrible things from the, you know, period that's not that in the not that distant past, that was within living memory of my parents and grandparents. And I was involved in a class called Civil Rights and Justice with one of the original civil rights organizers from that period. And you know, it was an amazing and deeply immersive way to very quickly shatter my sense of what my state was, my community was, my history was. And, you know, it's interesting that you kind of started the conversation with the question about my name, because, you know, my great-great-grandfather, who had my name, was in Alabama, you know, in the 1800s. And so when you think about legacy and history and the things that come with that and the responsibilities that come with that, I think I felt this immense kind of baggage and pressure to do something with that, not to be racked by guilt over it or to throw up my hands and give up, but to channel it into something that felt productive and meaningful in the present day. And I think that's a lot of people who respond negatively to these ideas of justice or equity, I think, are too instantly sort of internalizing the blame, I guess, and they respond defensively rather than looking at it and saying, you know what, none of us chose the world that we woke up in this morning, but we can choose how we respond to it and how we try and make it a better place, how we try and make it more equitable. And so that period in my life, I think, was really, really instrumental in setting me on this path, because I think I had been very insulated from the world, not in a sense of, you know, financial privilege, but I think just in isolation, living in a very, very remote place, living with people who were all very, very much like me, and getting into a city, you know, getting into a metro with 1.2 million people, hearing about the history of the state and our kind of collective involvement and complicity in that, really, really, I think, spurred for me a lot of deep thinking about the world that I lived in and the world I wanted to try and help create.
Did you feel any sense of separation or tension in terms of how the younger kindred was I suppose, changing course or going on a different path than the family tradition or family business, or even you referenced there coming to your own ideas or conclusions around faith and belief. Were you aware of that sort of what you might call a separation or a transition? How did that play out?
Yeah, I think it's something that is probably to some degree a universal experience of that everyone can relate to, of understanding that as you grow, as you experience new things, you aren't going to be the same person that your parents are, right? Or that your family kind of on a composite level maybe is. And that's something that definitely tracked for me. I mean, I think I knew at an early age that by early age, I guess here I mean probably around middle school period, that there was something different about me that was different from my peers. And I, you know, I knew that I was gay. And at the time, that was something that was very, I think, very difficult in the Deep South, in the rural South, in the extremely religious communities. And so I lived, I think, with a lot of fear and a lot of shame and a lot of repression for a long period of time, where I was really beating myself up about how I, you know, at the time kind of felt that who I was somehow some sort of moral failing. And I didn't want to disappoint anyone, because I feel like I'm very much a type A, you know, extremely detail oriented, ambitious person, and always have been. And I couldn't figure out what I was doing wrong in that, mm-hmm. in that situation. And so I think that led to a lot of pulling back or isolation from the traditions or the norms or the expectations. And I think that it, you know, to the question that you posed earlier about social awakenings, I do think that it was probably one of the earliest realizations that gave me certainly not an identical perspective at all, but I think it gave me a sense of empathy for people who are dealing with something that makes them, you know, marginalized or feeling like they're an outsider in a situation, feeling like they don't have the support system they need, or they don't have the right tools to figure out how to get what they need personally. So it gave me that sense. And I never wanted anyone to ever feel like that I, you know, to the extent that I could be involved and help and avoid that. I never wanted anyone to ever feel isolated, to feel alone, to feel judged or marginalized or afraid. And I think that experience was, you know, frankly, I think painful for all parties. I think it was painful for my family. It was painful for me. And the most painful part of everything, I think, was every single person in the dynamic deeply, deeply loved each other and deeply cared about each other, and was just coming at the situation from vastly different perspectives, lived experiences, backgrounds, you know, cultural influences, religious influences. And so, you know, I try to use that as a touch point when I talk about my own kind of work in social justice and connecting with communities that maybe don't share your views, because I do think that so often, and especially in the social justice world, we talk with people who agree with us, we have lunch with people who agree with us, we listen to podcasts hosted by people who agree with us, and really that's not very hard to do. What's hard to do is to have conversations that are tough with people who don't agree with you but love you, you know, and finding a way to square that circle, to kind of push through the discomfort and love as a verb, not just as an emotion. And I think that's, you know, what my family and I have done with each other. It's very complex and complicated, as I think all families probably are, but I have deep, deep love for them, and I know that they have it for me. And so I think that experience has kind of driven a lot of my work. And I think a lot of my own, I think maybe we'll talk about this a little bit later on around kind of how work culture can kind of be a manifestation of personal experiences. But I think for a long time, my desire to kind of always be looking for the next thing or to achieve or to kind of accomplish something was rooted in ultimately wanting to do enough, be enough, accomplish enough to kind of set that right. And part of my process of growing up and growing emotionally was just realizing that that was a sort of a fool's errand. You know, it wasn't ever that I wasn't doing enough or succeeding enough or any other thing. It was that wasn't the issue. The issue was finding a way to be in a world, be in a community, be in a family where we were able to move past that and realize that ultimately we don't have to agree, but our job is to love each other. Our job is to support each other. And I think that that's something that I've tried to create in my lived communities and my adopted families as well, is this sense of coming together out of shared experience, shared purpose, shared goals, and making the metrics of success more about, are we getting what we need from each other? Are we supporting each other? Not are we accomplishing these, you know, arbitrary sets of metrics that frankly aren't that important.
It seems so prescient and relevant to particularly where the United States, but not just the United States, we could take any number of countries, are in terms of divisiveness and the need, and referencing Alabama, but you know, the notion of the beloved community of Martin Luther King and the idea of seeing the goodness and the humanity in all and each other. And I guess there's nowhere more difficult to some extent to start with than at home, if the other is seen as off you. But, you know, by virtue of a nation state or indeed the world, we are all a sort of one family to one extent or another. But the microcosm there of which played out in your family, and obviously this is very private and personal territory, so I don't expect you to kind of divulge too much on the specifics, but I'm just wondering, are there any particular tools or insights as to how you and your family navigated that period in the early days? Because I do get I guess some of my own background is in youth work, and I would have a sense of, you know, the repression and discrimination that has gone on and still goes on, and how it can lead to internalized, whether it be anxiety or depression or suicide ideation, particularly amongst LGBTQI plus communities and so on. So, you know, in this period, you're a much younger man, and you don't necessarily have access to supports or therapists or all of these things. Like, and maybe your parents never did either. And like, where do you develop the skill set, or do you muddle your way through, or, you know, was there anything there that maybe looking back that you think has was pivotal?
Yeah, that's a really, I think, profound question in a number of ways. My initial sense of how to answer it, I think, is that I don't know that I had the answer, and I don't know that there's a sort of playbook that people can use, because I think every situation is unique. But what I will say is, I think because of a unique combination of factors of how I sort of operate in the world, and maybe that it isn't even that unique. I think there's a really good book on this topic that I read maybe a year or so ago called The Velvet Rage, and it's all about it's not a new book, but it's I think it's continually relevant. It's all about how people who grow up gay as the initially, I think, was the kind of framing of that book, but LGBT, I think more broadly, are used to being high achieving, high performing, extremely kind of bright people by necessity, because they felt that, obviously no community is a monolith, but I think in a lot of cases, people feel like they need to do that to compensate for the way the world reacts to their identity or other parts of them that they don't have control over. So the parts that they do have control over, they feel like they have to be hyper-managed. They have to be, you know, the sort of the best little boy in the world, to quote the, you know, another book on that topic. And so I think that for me was how I responded initially, was to sort of not talk about it, not make it a thing, try and kind of keep my head down and be that, you know, good and loving son and family member who worked really hard, studied really hard, you know, did well for himself and would make his family proud, And I think that as I have gotten older, I wonder whether I really did myself a disservice there in not kind of elevating the issue earlier, or making it something that wasn't just something that we talked about once and then brushed under the rug forever. And so as I got older, you know, I decided that it was something I did want to talk about more, and I sort of forced the issue. And I think ultimately that has to be situational for everybody, because, you know, people have different levels of safety and of relationships with their family. But I do think the biggest takeaway there, if I could impart anything of value to somebody else, is that you ultimately have to understand that no individual thing you do is ever going to compensate for who you are, because you also shouldn't have to do that. You don't have to compensate for who you are. You have to just be who you are. And I think that we set people up for disappointment, for failure, and for emotional struggles when we tell them that it'll get better at some point. Maybe it will, and maybe it won't. Maybe the thing that gets better is you just get a new, you know, you get a new situation. You go to a new place. You build a new family. You have a chosen family. I think sometimes we, in our desire to comfort people or to be responsive and be available, we lean on phrases or ideas or concepts that maybe aren't universally applicable. And so I always think about that, because so many times people told me, you know, that people would come around and then, you know, you wait 10, 15 years and you feel like they haven't. And ultimately that makes you think that you did something wrong, because it's like, well, if all these people told me that they would come around and they didn't, you know, what did I do wrong to make that not happen? And I think that is one of the ways where I would say to people, if anyone asked, you know, you have to kind of chart your own course in that sense and adjust your own expectations based on your lived experience, because you ultimately are the person who knows your situation best. I think nobody else on the outside will ever know or understand it, but there's a big world out there. And I think, you know, living in London, living in New York, living in DC, I found my people. I found people who had similar experiences or had very different ones, but were kind of aligned in a bunch of different ways. And yeah, it definitely has improved, both with my family and with my own individual life. I mean, I'm very, very happy and engaged. And, you know, I think that there's a great big world and a lot of promise and possibility, but I think you have to chart your own course and be mindful about your expectations in a way that takes care of you, not kind of adjust to what other people want for you.
Thank you for sharing all that, Kindred. Could I ask, I suppose where I'm coming from this is that I'm engaged in therapy myself on a personal level, but also through my studies in studying psychotherapy and counseling. And was that part of your experience in navigating all this, particularly perhaps during your college years and onwards? Because you definitely seem to have a lot of clarity and insight, and obviously people can arrive at that level of clarity on their own volition, but often they need external sort of supports around that as well.
Yeah, I think it wasn't formally part of my process, but I do think that I benefited from a lot of really, really mindful people who were in my life and who provided resources or counsel. It was something that was part of my training when after undergraduate, I did the Episcopal Service Corps in North Carolina, and we did service leadership trainings and on Fridays, and we would do a lot of literature readings and kind of the idea was around building your spiritual practice, and it was rooted in Anglican or Episcopal traditions, but a lot of it was around, you know, creating mindfulness, creating space for thinking about the way in which we operate in the world and live in the world and how we forgive ourselves, how we forgive others, how we operate from a mindset of abundance, not of scarcity. And I think that that's something that ultimately really kind of adjusted my own thinking. But I think the other part was just time. And I think maybe in some ways I have, you know, for over half my life now, I've been responding to the way that others responded to me. And I think that has shifted how I think about it, because there's just been a lot of time to ruminate and a lot of time to give myself and others kind of grace to be where we are at any given point in time. But I also think that part of it was, you know, my parents, to give a particular example, when I was born, my mother was 25, my father was 28. I turn 32 tomorrow. And, you know, the there's nothing like getting beyond the point in time where your parents had you and still feeling completely inadequate and still feeling completely ill-equipped to keep you know, to keep houseplants alive, much less children.
Yeah.
To realize that everybody's just doing the best they can, you know. Absolutely. and they love you fiercely and they care about you, and there's no guidebook. There's nothing that tells you how to be a good anything, much less parent and support system. So I think part of it was just that process of getting older, and you know, I know it's probably a cliche, but I do think, at least for me, it's certainly true. The older I get, the wiser my parents and other family members seem and are. But the thing is, I think they already, you know, they already had that. It just took me a while to realize it.
Yeah, absolutely. I was struck there by your the service and the reflection that you undertook in relation to perhaps scriptures, and obviously having a religious influence come to bear there. But, you know, this sense that religion, or at least some religions, or sadly most religions, cause a lot of harm, or at least their interpretations cause a lot of harm in relation to the gay community and the LGBT, the broader LGBTQ communities. But yet, like most things, it's often not black or white or binary, in that the same traditions gave you a lot of sustenance and growth and inspiration to almost help you navigate. And it's interesting to me that, you know, that seems still very much alive in you, but yet you've found your own course with it. Well, firstly, am I reading that accurately? And secondly, do you have any form of practice or systems at present in which to, that you use to sustain yourself?
Yeah, it's such a good question. And I think it's something that I'm not sure that I have a sufficient answer to. I think, you know, my own interpretation of my religious tradition. So I grew up Protestant and Christian. I think my understanding of the world and the sort of fundamental sense of what we are called to do as good, you know, community members, neighbors, citizens, is certainly informed by that. And you know, as I got older, when I was an undergraduate, I actually took a class, an elective course. I went to a liberal arts college, so, you know, sometimes things, the course offerings were a bit eclectic, to say the least. But one of them was called "Who Is Jesus?" And it was all about, you know, kind of critically reading a bunch of different interpretations and assessments of Christianity, of Christ, of like the philosophies and you know, a number of different kind of angles there. And I felt from that point very, very compelled by this idea of radical justice, of Christianity at its core as a call for radical justice, for radical equality, for radical community, and the idea of being, you know, in the world but not of the world, I think is particularly powerful. Not maybe in the ways that it's been applied by some people, as a sense of being an exclusionary or marginalizing metric, but rather as this idea of sort of eschewing the ideas of the world at large. So, you know, not thinking about capitalism for capitalism's sake, not thinking about environmental degradation for profit, you know, not thinking about exclusion or marginalization based on identity or you know, characteristics. I see when I choose to look at scripture or religious teachings, and I have to say I'm not deeply, deeply involved, as much as you know, my family or others would like me to be, I'm sure. But I do see a call for compassion for the poor, for the marginalized, for people who are facing persecution, for people who need help, people who are, you know, refugees or asylum seekers. And that informs my own idea of social justice for sure. And has, I think, from the beginning, I felt early on a dissonance between the religious communities, particularly I think in the United States, that are so deeply aligned with political parties that I almost see a sort of, you know, extreme acrobatics, basically, to sort of contort themselves in a way that makes ideological sense. You know, that you can be for extractive policies, for war, for any number of things, right? And claim that mantle, because what I see when I look at Christianity and when I look at Christ is a social movement and a movement leader, and ultimately a call for radical justice, for compassion, for equity. And so I think to the extent that I claim that tradition and that mantle, I claim it through that lens, because I think that in my mind, it is not a rewriting of that idea or that text, but rather a reorienting to what it always was. I don't think that it's revisionist. I think it's restorative.
Yeah. I would share that view as well. I certainly get a sense that over 2,000 years or more, too many agendas and egos have got involved in rewriting narratives and to suit those agendas. And that if there was a figure of Jesus around today, he would more than likely kick their ass in a peaceful, nonviolent way. In the moneylender sense of the word. But if we...
Right,
if we,
turning over tables in the church, right?
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
the thing.
And if we strip it all back, that, you know, you mentioned love as a verb, and if this Jesus character was here or was there, that if love is the be end and all, ultimately the guiding force, then really we don't have these issues of prejudice, discrimination, or division, because it sort of conquers all ultimately. But I guess that's the big mission. And if it was easy, we would be there already. So I guess it's in process, which is why it's a verb. So Kindred, let's move along. And for maybe the last almost decade or so, you've been deeply immersed in the world of community organizing, NGOs, civil society. You've spent time in London and in DC. And elsewhere, you've traveled a lot more, obviously, time in New York City as well. Can you talk to me about some of the organizations you've worked with and some of the experiences, the groups, and the insights that you've had over the years?
Sure, yeah, happy to. I started my career in this world when I was in graduate school in the UK. I worked for an organization called Redress, which focused on reparations for victims and survivors of torture, particularly people who had been political prisoners or targets of repressive regimes. And that was something that I was doing while I was getting a master's in international relations. And I always knew that I wanted to do something in the human rights world, but having that experience to get to really do that work while I was at university and experience that was incredible. I was able to attend the Global Summit on Sexual Violence and Conflict that was hosted at the time by the UK Foreign Secretary and represent Redress there. And it was just an amazing early exposure to international activism and advocacy that was going on behalf of very, very important cause and issue. When I left the UK, I had the opportunity to, I knew that I wanted to do civil and human rights work and wasn't quite sure where I wanted to go. I felt very strongly that I wanted to go to Washington or to New York, just because those in my country are the centers of power for NGO work and advocacy and activism in particular. But I had an offer to go to the Southern Poverty Law Center, which was in Montgomery, Alabama. And there was part of me that was really, really hesitant to go back so soon because I had left in 2012. This was 2014. I didn't really want to do that, coming from London, going back to Montgomery, which is it's 3.5 hours south of where I grew up and very, very different. Alabama, for those who don't know, is kind of a mixture of everything from the mountains in the north, the Appalachian foothills, to the Gulf Coast at the very bottom, and basically everything in between. Every sort of landmass that you find in the southeast is in Alabama because it runs north to south. And so I grew up in the foothills and what you would view as more of an Appalachian foothills sort of place. Montgomery is very, very old, traditional kind of low-lying Southland, and the culture is a lot slower as a result and very, very different. So I was a little unsure about that, but the work was incredible. And I knew that if I were to be going back to the United States to do work in civil and human rights, that Southern Poverty Law Center was one of the best places to do it, regardless of where it was. And so I was really grateful to take that opportunity. And that shaped my own sense of how to integrate domestic policy, domestic civil rights, and view it through the intersecting lenses of international human rights, of international campaigns. And I think that too often people think of them as silos, but ultimately what happens in one country can lead to ripple effects elsewhere. I mean, if you look at the nonviolent protest movements around the world and how they've been informed by each other, or the social media revolutions that have happened from the Arab Spring to Me Too to Black Lives Matter, you know, what happens in one part of the world definitely affects the others. And so I felt very, very grateful to have that experience. And that ultimately led me to New York to work on media and advocacy for a couple trials they were doing there, actually around LGBTQ conversion therapy and putting an end to that practice. And that felt really very personally, important to me for a number of reasons. But I ended up getting an offer to move to New York and work alongside Amnesty International and Oxfam through a joint campaign they had called Control Arms at the United Nations. And given what I had done in international relations, I really, really welcomed that opportunity. So I moved to New York, lived with six other people in, a shotgun row house apartment in Brooklyn and made it work for a few years. But loved that experience and loved the chance to meet people from all over the world. Ultimately, over time, it led me to a number of different organizations, and I found a mix, I think a nice mix, but an unexpected mix of domestic and international organizations. I ended up working for the Vera Institute of Justice, which is one of the largest criminal justice reform organizations in the U.S., and they also do immigration reform. I was really fortunate to get to build a digital team there from scratch. I started as the only digital person, and when I left, we were a team of four, and I was able to really grow my own skills and abilities there, and really grateful for that opportunity. But it was an interesting time because it was the Trump years, and there was this weird mixture of optimism on the criminal justice reform front because there was a bipartisan consensus that it was important. At the same time, there was an almost overnight assault on immigration and immigrants' rights. Mm. And so it was a deeply, deeply stressful position to kind of constantly be doing communications work there because it was one five-alarm fire after another. And, you would be doing something on Saturday night at 11. And I felt by the end of it extremely grateful for that work, but I also understood why generations of kind of movement and advocacy comms people before me had talked about burnout and had talked about needing a change of pace. So I moved into philanthropy, doing communications for a progressive foundation, and really enjoyed that step back from the kind of more frenetic pace in a way that still allowed me to feel connected to the movements, allowed me to still feel like I was playing an important role in helping, helping kind of tell the story of organizations that maybe didn't have the infrastructure or the communications team to do that on their own. And over time, I realized, because I'd had, as I mentioned, a number of different experiences, and I realized that I really liked project work and time specific work and jumping kind of around and being able to have my hand in a lot of different jars, because I felt that a lot of organizations were internally focused and weren't really thinking about the external landscape of what's going on, not only in the world, but among their peers, and kind of learning from each other and incorporating best practices. Because I think there was a zero-sum thinking, and maybe still is among some nonprofits, that someone else's success or gain necessarily implies your loss. You know, you, if they're getting something, you must not be. And so there was a hesitance to share kind of best practices or strategies there. And so I started doing some consulting kind of as a hobby and on the side early on, and most of it for free, and really realized I loved it. And I loved that I could take something I was learning in one place and apply it elsewhere and give people that connective tissue that I didn't see happening in the broader world. Mm-hmm. So since I've started consulting, I've been really, really fortunate to work with a number of organizations, but some that I think your listeners might be familiar with include USAID, which is the U.S. government's International Development Fund and program, Global Citizen and New America, Girl Rising, all over the board. You know, a lot of organizations from international development, ending gender-based violence, ending extreme poverty, fighting hate and extremism, working for vaccine equity and the IP access waivers to allow other countries to produce vaccines rather than simply get donated vaccines. I think it kind of runs the board, but the thing that has been so amazing to me is that I feel like every single step of my career helped inform what came next. Yeah. But there was no overarching strategy at the time that, you know, I wasn't following a 5 or 10 year plan. And I heard someone say once, and I think it's really, really true, at least for me, invaluable, that you only tell yourself a narrative of your trajectory after it's happened. You know, we all find ways to rationalize kind of how it happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it wasn't obvious at the time, right? It's just in retrospect.
Yeah, I absolutely identify with that. And I, in many ways, you know, I feel like strategy is important insofar as it's possible, that there's so many unknowns that we're navigating at any given time. And in many ways, I suppose my own spiritual understanding is that ultimately, when all is said and done, so much of it is a great mystery. And it's about how we learn to navigate and dance and walk with grace in that great mystery. And in terms of your new undertaking, the new consultancy and the work that you do, and, you know, I heard a couple of times you mentioned just the frenetic work pace, the overachievement, the type A, all that kind of stuff. You know, I would also identify with some of that where my wife goes away. I don't necessarily hit the couch and binge out on Netflix. I just do a ton of work.
Yeah.
And it's like, at some level, there's a dangerous compulsion there that I love working, but it doesn't always serve me in the sense that I end up dealing with fatigue and the danger of burnout always being there. I haven't experienced it severely at one point in my life, and possibly multiple mini burnout periods, but thankfully have now developed new insights and practices that I can see warning signs, and I can see the behaviors and habits and tendencies. But how are you navigating that kind of push and pull factor, not just in your own life, but in how you seek to implement a new culture, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think it's something that I've been thinking a lot about for about a year now, because I've read some incredible pieces on, and Helen Peterson had an amazing essay in BuzzFeed couple years back about millennials and burnout. And I think it really resonated with me at the time, just because of what I mentioned before with the sort of frenetic pace of the communications work in immigration and criminal justice reform space. Particularly, I think, because of the always on culture. You know, in communications, there is a definite pressure to be responsive and to be doing work kind of at all hours of the day. And, you know, I don't think I am alone in that. In fact, I know I'm not. In the research I've done, as I was kind of trying to figure out a solution from my perspective and in my own work and business, you know, I found that 58% of people who work in consulting experience repeating symptoms of burnout, which is to say kind of sustained and conditional, not something that, you know, is temporary, but is more chronic. And when you think about the kind of modern economy, there are, especially now with the Great Resignation and the changes that a lot of people are making after COVID, we've got in the United States, we've got nearly 60 million freelance workers, you know, who are either contractors, who are consultants, who are gig workers, who are doing their own thing. And many of them are doing multiple jobs. And so, you know, as I was reading all of this, I was thinking to myself that there has to be a better system that we can create. Because we live in, you know, we live in the culture that is created for us. But I think to the extent that any of us have power to change that, especially if we are working on our own as a, you know, as a solo, a sole entrepreneur or a solo freelancer or consultant, you know, you can start to sort of change those practices in your own life and take what you learn to help others, or to at least share those findings and see what happens with it. You know, I felt that last year I was incredibly lucky to have a lot of work and a lot of amazing experiences. I got to go to the G20 and to COP26 and a number of other things, and, you know, would have 70, 80 hour work weeks. And I just felt at the end of the year that I had failed somehow, even as by every, you know, objective measure, I had been successful, because the failure was that I didn't feel happy about any of it. I felt depleted. I felt more critical of myself, not less. And the more I tried to do, the less I felt I was doing any of it particularly well. Yeah. And so I felt that I had to get to a point where either I would scale back or scale up, but I couldn't stay the same. And either way, I knew that I wanted to create a framework for sustainability, well-being, workplace culture that worked for me so that it could work for other people. You know, before, I think a lot of people tell you, you know what, just build your business, figure it out as you go, bring people in to support you, and culture comes later. I really didn't want that to be the case. Yeah. I wanted culture to be baked in from the beginning. And, you know, so I was asking myself really tough questions of like, is there a consulting model that isn't just tied to what the client wants and being immediately responsive and giving them everything and working 16-hour days every single day? And I'm very much a 32, you know, Google Chrome tab browser person at all times.
Only 32. Like, that's
per window.
Yeah.
And you know, I love to sort of open something to read later and really make my way down the rabbit hole. And as I read more and more, I you know, I came across a lot of the work that is happening in Scandinavia in particular around the 4-day work week model, and was really, really drawn to that idea and thought, you know what, this is the time, the place, the position of life to try it. People are already getting used to remote working. They're getting used to, you know, consultants being in different time zones or in different places and responding when they can. And so I wanted that to be something that was part of the company as we were building out and you know, enforcing paid leave, enforcing better benefits, making sure that contractors and freelancers are actually paid enough to afford their own health insurance, which fortunately in Ireland is not something that you have to worry about. But in the United States, if you don't have a full-time employer, the cost of insurance is on you. And, you know, 60 million Americans freelancing is an awful lot of people to not have health insurance by default. So what would it look like if we built a model that built in rates that allowed them to pay for all of that? And those were sort of the kinds of things I was thinking about on my own, in my own experience, because, you know, I was figuring it all out by myself initially. But like I said, if you learn all of those things and you have the experiences, why not use them to try and help other people and share that, so that we can create a better system that is more equitable? And ultimately, if we're working with social justice organizations, which I do, and all my clients so far have been nonprofit organizations, you know, I feel a duty to use their funds appropriately as well, because they're paying me and they are tax exempt organizations. They are getting, you know, benefits as charitable organizations. And I like to think of myself as a sort of satellite extension of that of that mission, that vision, those values, and reflect them in my own, even if I'm not technically a nonprofit organization, because I think it's just the authenticity I want to bring to the work.
Well, it's also the case that these organizations often or sometimes don't necessarily, I mean, they can be excellent at promoting and cultivating the values externally within the community and so on, but the practice internally isn't always in harmony with the mission or the value base. And, you know, we can only go so far as to affect change with other organizations. You know, there's all sorts of factors at play. You mentioned culture and governance being another one. Leadership is a big question, but the only thing at the end of the day most of us are in control of is ourselves. And you, by virtue of starting to model a behavior set and a cultural set, can affect the change. So in effect, what I'm hearing is be the change here is that, and I think there is a generational shift, and I'm conscious of a friend of mine, Joe O'Connor, who's now the chief executive of the 4-Day Week Global. He's based in the United States now. And it feels to me that the 4-Day Week is eventually going to become, hopefully, like the weekend is. You'd be going, well, why not? You know, because it's over 100 years later since we had the weekend as a concept. At some point, people were going, you can't be crazy. You're going to take 2 days off. And but there has been a regressive push over the last 30 years or so. I will always sort of blame Thatcherism, but you know, in whatever guise you might want to frame it, but it's been a pushback and a cutback of workers' rights. And like, if our wellness and our happiness and our minds and our families and our communities aren't benefiting from the culture that we're operating from, then what ultimately is the point of it all? So I certainly welcome the fact that you're proposing to embody that, and I suspect that it's not that easy also, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's definitely difficult, not only externally, but also internally. I think, you know, there's an urge that I have after years of using any free time I had to think about how to innovate, how to come up with a cool new campaign or idea for someone I was working with. You know, I've tried to kind of use my, I mean, we're talking on a Friday. This is technically a day that I'm not working and I'm talking about work. Caught. So it's not a
we're both caught. Yeah.
But I think the framework there is that I wanted a day to breathe, to have some time to actually think, because ultimately, you know, I don't know how many of your listeners are creatives, but I would imagine a fair lot of them. And ultimately, if we operate solely by the terms of an extractive economy that wants us to produce at all costs, as creatives, the well is going to run dry. I mean, you have to have time to recharge. You have time. Absolutely. You have to have time to rest. And I think if you are prioritizing that in the same way that you're prioritizing creating good work, being accountable, sharing your schedule in advance so you can work something out with your client, it's ultimately going to serve them better as well, because what you produce, what you create, and how you're able to show up for work are all going to be drastically better if you have a higher quality of life, if you have a better work-life balance, if you have a chance to step away and just read a couple magazines that are going to spark an idea, you know, or listen to a podcast
every time
where you hear an insightful new idea. I think that's where I get my ideas, you know, and if you're never taking time away to do that, I think the work suffers. And so I think we have to get away from this idea that getting away from work means you're not doing anything of value. I think sometimes getting away from work is the thing of value. It's what allows us to show up better the next time.
Absolutely. And also the fact that work need not be the end goal here, that the in many ways the traditional purpose of work was to create income for food and shelter and
exactly.
living life, you know? So
exactly.
I like that we're at a point of re-questioning that. And in our mutual defense, I will offer that I also do not take, I'm not on a 4-day week, but I do not schedule, most things on a Friday, even though we are recording on a Friday. But this does not
this
feel
is
like
worry.
Work to
it's
me.
Not work. Yeah,
it's
exactly.
not work. I like, you know, and I actually intentionally never, developed this podcast as a work project for that reason, that there was a point in time where I thought about scaling it up, and maybe still will do, but it has to be resourced in such a way that it doesn't feel like burdensome. And so every conversation I do, I enjoy, and that's my modus, you know? And I think you have to keep that sense of joy alive. So Kindred, I think our time is, well, firstly, I want to kick you off air because I want you to go and enjoy the rest of your day. but there is a lot more we could talk about, and we have covered an awful lot. But is there anything you would like to conclude with yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I think I really appreciate you kind of diving into the things that make people who they are. I'm a listener. I started listening back in 2019, and I really appreciate that. I think it's so interesting to have the opportunity to talk about things in a way that just show how they inform what you do, who you become, rather than focusing on what you did and who you became, because I think that ultimately we all have a story that informs why we're doing what we're doing, why we love what we love. And I, you know, I would say that the thing for me is probably the full circle moment is, you know, as part of this endeavor that I've gone on to kind of strike out and try and create something, you know, family culture and my background was something that was really, really critical in how I thought about what that would look like. And the last piece that I just wanted to share as part of that is, you know, in addition to trying to create kind of a sustainable working environment for myself and for others, I really wanted to build in literally paying it forward and literally giving back to the places that kind of helped make me who I am. At some point, I would love to do that for others who are part of the team. But I would love to encourage anyone who might know of amazing organizations in the South of the United States or in Appalachia that are doing incredible work to check out our website for our company, because we're going to be giving an unrestricted general operating grant to an organization there. And that was something that was very, very important to me, because I think this is something that happens all over the world. And I know it's a thing in Ireland as well, with people who grow up in small communities and small towns, usually for economic necessity or reasons beyond their control. They feel they have to leave the communities that made them to be able to do whatever career it is they want. I hope that changes with the remote world, but I'm not sure that it will, and to the degree that it needs to. So I very much wanted to be, even though I'm now in DC and not living in the South and not part of that community in a day-to-day basis, I wanted that to be part of my own operational strategy. You know, what does it look like to give back and literally give back in an accountable way? So we're really excited as a company to be giving an unrestricted grant to an organization there that's doing civil and human rights work. And I'm so excited to embark on that process. So if you do know of anyone, I encourage you to check out our website, which hopefully we can maybe put in the show notes. But yeah, I think that's the biggest thing, is just to anybody who's listening and considering something like this. You know, I think it's been such an immensely valuable experience for me to get to meet so many different people, do work with a number of different issue areas, and learn from each and every one of them, and then have that inform my own strategies of what does it mean to be a good, you know, community member, global citizen, local citizen, friend and neighbor. And so I'm super grateful for you, Ruri, for providing the opportunity to chat about this and for all the work that you're doing. I really appreciate the concept of just kind of deconstructing whatever corporate speak or NGO speak people usually do with their days. And I've really enjoyed this conversation. So thank you so much for providing a platform.
Oh, an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Kindred. I really appreciate it and really enjoyed it. Some great insights and stories. And it was great to learn more about you after being in touch over the years. And I know you were an early adapter to the podcast, so grateful for that. And I will just give that website now. I think from what I recall, it's kmstrategiesgroup.com. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Great. Thanks again, Kindred. Absolute pleasure talking to you. And best of luck with all the great work. And keep those Fridays free.
Will do. Thank you.
Hello, Ruairi here again. A huge thanks to Kindred for taking the time to talk with me and for sharing some of his inspiring journey and insights. If you know others who might like to hear this episode, please do send them a link and mention it on social media. You can also help the podcast reach more people by subscribing to the Love and Courage podcast in your podcast app. This means you get updates on each episode, and also ratings and reviews in the apps are really appreciated. You can find me also, Ruairi McKiernan, on various social media platforms, and I have an email newsletter on my website. Head over to loveandcourage.org, where you can also choose to chip in as a once-off or a monthly patron, and a huge thanks to all who do that already. And a reminder that if you want information on my book, Hitching for Hope, just head over to hitchingforhope.com. That is it, folks. A huge thanks again for listening. Thanks to everyone who's part of the Love and Courage community. Thanks for all your love and support. Until next time.